Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints. This is your host, Don Nikoloff, and we are now experiencing the early part of January 19th on the East Coast, still January 18th on the West Coast. And before we get to tonight's guest, I have just a couple of short announcements to make. Number one, we have been talking about, for the past week now, a rally for presidential candidate, Congressman Dr. Ron Paul, and this is going to take place at the Haven in Winter Park, Florida, on January 23rd from 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. Of course, that's Eastern Standard Time, and it's going to be sponsored by both Peter Nelson from the Haven. He's actually active Army on, let's say, injury leave right now. He's healing up, and he'll be there for the event. He's a big Ron Paul supporter. Also co-hosted and co-sponsored by Fred Bedali, the drummer and leader of the group Soul Function. It is an absolutely fantastic R&B group. They actually play country. They do some jazz, they do swing, a little bit of everything. And I've heard the group, they're just absolutely fantastic. And I'm saying that from a professional viewpoint. Now, the event is also going to be streamed live here on BBS Radio TV. And as we have more specifics, we'll tell you about those. We'll know a bit more by the end of this weekend or by next Monday. And I will be doing two shows prior to that event with Fred Bedali talking about Ron Paul's candidacy. That'll be next Monday and Tuesday. And the event will take place, again, 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Depending on how I'm feeling, they may have to play an old show, or possibly I'll go back on the air again in an hour and a half after that event. We'll see. But if you are in the Winter Park, Florida area, by all means, stop off and pay a visit at the Haven Lounge, and that is at the corner of Forsyth and Aloma, or the address is 6700 Aloma Avenue in Winter Park, Florida. And their phone number is area code 407-673-2712. There is a $10 cover charge, but that's to defray the cost. There's going to be snacks and munchies as well as lots of good music, and there will be a portion of the program in between the musical sets where we will have some live discussion on bbsradio.com about Ron Paul's candidacy, and you'll get to hear Fred Bedali speak, as well as yours truly. That said, I would like to give a couple of shout-outs. Mr. Ken Adachi, out in California, who is a sometimes guest here on the show, has been listening, especially tonight with our guest. He's very interested in the topics that we're going to be discussing, so I wanted to give a shout-out to Ken. Also to Karen, Bob, and Bill, David, Crenshaw, Zachariah, Sheila, and Jill, and the General, Cherie in Nashville, and then we got Michael in New York, John in California, and my man Preston out in Rock Island, Tennessee. What's up, bro? And anybody else whose name I forgot, I apologize. We would spend the whole show reading off all the people that want me to do a shout out, but these are our consistent listeners and our supporters, and we owe it to them to acknowledge their presence on the show. So with that, we're going to bring tonight's guest. He has become a regular on Evident Footprints since the show began back in June. And, of course, I joined BBS Radio in the last week of November, and I've been getting lots of email, lots of calls, lots of positive feedback from people, especially about this guest. They are just enthralled with the information he brings. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, teacher, and a good friend, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to Evident Footprints. How are you this evening?
I'm doing well, Don. How are you?
I'm just hunky-dory. Can't you tell?
Yeah, well, you always sound good.
Well, I'm just pumped up. I'm really looking forward to this event. You know, I've not really been a political activist, but I've taken an interest in what's going on in politics because of all the underhanded stuff that goes on in the background, of course. That's what birthed my show, we'll say. So I try to stay upbeat, even though a lot of this information is very depressing at times. And the good thing about your appearance on my show is that you always enlighten us. You bring a lot of great information and wisdom to the show. So we want to thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate those comments. I hope I can live up to the reputation.
Oh, you have. It doesn't take much effort on your part. All you have to do is begin speaking. We have been talking in the past few weeks about different types of technology, a bit about Nikola Tesla and some other scientists who you had come into contact with and had gotten to know fairly well, Dominic Lucchese, Gene Carini, Warren Goetz, and Otis Carr. And, of course, we talked about Nikola Tesla. And we were talking about some what we were calling suppressed technologies, the technologies that have been kept away from the benefit of the masses, but still out there being used. And I know you wanted to talk some more about that tonight. I had actually asked you to go in a particular direction, which we will go. We'll leave that as a surprise for the listeners. But I'll turn the mic over to you. And wait with a bated breath.
Well, okay. I think the best way to go down the path that we intend to follow tonight is to just do a brief rehash of one of Tesla's most incredible accomplishments, and that would be his magnifying transmitter. Now, that machine was used for two different purposes. The Wardenclyffe establishment on Long Island, New York, was set up as a world communications center, and that, of course, was one of his greatest dreams, was to supply the world with all of the possible means of communication from one well-designed plant. And I personally believe that he could have done this had it not been for his falling out with J.P. Morgan and the loss of financial support that went with that. But the other less known purpose for the magnifying transmitter was its use as a device for transmitting power without wires. And in order to accomplish this, it was used in a pulsed mode, which, of course, is very different from the setup for communication, which was a CW mode device, or a continuous wave device, as they are popularly referred to. And that work was done by him in Colorado Springs in the early 1900s, late 1800s, with some very spectacular results. Now, the thing that's interesting about this device is that he was using literally millions of volts, probably a pressure of somewhere between 10 and 20 million volts to drive this device, and at a fairly high frequency. And the purpose, of course, was to excite the Earth for the accomplishment of transmitting power into the ground rather than into a transmission line or into the air, which he had also investigated earlier, in such a way that a receiver could be placed anywhere in the world, and if tuned to that particular frequency, suddenly the recipient would be able to take power out of the ground to fire up his home, to supply light and heat, or whatever other needs he might have. Now, during the time that he was working to accomplish this end, he had set his transmitter into motion in Colorado Springs, and 26 miles away from the transmitter, he had a battery of huge lamps situated, which he was basically using as his receiving target, and he managed to light those lamps. I forget how much horsepower he transmitted, but it was a considerable amount, with an efficiency of over 99%. And this gave him a great deal of enthusiasm for attempting to do the same thing on a global basis. As a matter of fact, he bragged about the possibility of being able to power World's Fair in Brussels, which I guess was upcoming at that time, from his original generating station at Niagara Falls, New York, and accomplished this by means of this new technology without any wires. Well, the thing that's interesting about this whole experiment, of course, is that every time he fired up this device, he was literally disturbing the balance of the Earth's electric field. Now, if you view the Earth as a giant particle sitting in space, essentially, these changes in the electric field are definitely going to affect the ether and the space around it. And we don't really know too much about what that does because it's not the essence of radio. But if you figure that you have an antenna, which for all intents and purposes is 7,000 miles in diameter, you're going to definitely create a disturbance which may have some form of propagation associated with it. And the thing that's interesting about this is that it immediately brings us into realization that there have been other investigators and other scientists who talk about the fact that the electric field of the Earth and possibly the magnetic field of the Earth essentially combine in some way, shape, or form to create the biosphere and give support to the life energy that manifests in that little space. And this, of course, is the essence of all life on Earth. And the reason why this is interesting is because people like Wilhelm Reich, who investigated orgone energy, and T. Galin Hieronymus, who investigated eloptic energy, and also Clave Baxter, who started off as a lie detector technologist working for the police department, wound up experimenting with the intelligence and the unusual responses of plants and animals to disturbances in this field. And all of these people concluded that there is, in fact, another form of energy that manifests in this biosphere, and it is not radio, and it is not electromagnetic as we understand that force, and it is a thing unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring all this up is because the Air Force and the space agency eventually picked up on some of this, and they literally did experiments where they programmed a human being to interact with a plant that was wired up to electronic amplifiers and discriminators and could literally activate circuitry from thousands of miles away without any radio link whatsoever, only using the emotional experience of the operator and his interfacing with the plant to accomplish communication. And this was actually done from one of the space capsules that orbited the moon on the dark side of the moon. And the response was instantaneous when used with this bioenergetic coupling, and completely blotted out by interference and the physical properties of the moon when the same signals were attempted to be transmitted by radio. And so this leads us to a very interesting possibility, which is something that I deliberately wanted to lead into with this introduction, and that is that if this bioelectric field, or call it what you will, the orgon envelope, can transmit information instantaneously without being interfered with by heavenly bodies or the passage of time or any of the other things which normally impede radio circuits. One of the thoughts that I have entertained over the years is, wouldn't it be interesting if advanced civilizations were in fact using a technology based on this life force instead of the more primitive radio waves, which can take thousands of years to travel from one galaxy to another? And in fact, if this was the case, wouldn't it be interesting that all of these huge listening devices that we've positioned all over the world in an attempt to try and locate signals from outer space of an intelligent origin have essentially given us nothing that we know of, simply because maybe they're not using that primitive means of communication, Doc.
Mm-hmm.
Just a thought.
What I have been very interested in that, and I would guess I came to that interest rather naturally, not from necessarily from anything that I read, but just the things I noticed. In fact, I sort of did my own little experiment. It didn't turn out exactly like I wanted it to, and I'll explain. I played some classical music for a plant for a whole day. And it seemed to be doing quite well. In fact, it began flowering, and the plant just really looked healthy. The next day, I played jazz all day, and kind of progressive jazz, but nice music, melodic, nice chords, and the plant looked kind of relaxed. And then the third day, I played country music, and I noticed later on that day, the plant had up and gone. So that, anyway, that's a joke, Jim. You're supposed to laugh at that.
I was just going to say, where did it go? Down to the local bar for a drink?
It ended up with the dog, wherever the dog went. That's sort of a joke about that. But I actually did a study, seriously, and I noticed that certain types of music actually had an adverse effect on the plant. Regardless of my musical tastes, I would notice that certain types of music, certain types of rock music, or certain keys, or certain instrumentation, certain timbres of sound were offensive to the plant. And the plant would demonstrate over a period of time, sometimes just within a few hours, it would close up as if it was nighttime, for example, or it was trying to, or you would get the feeling it was trying to defend itself from some of the dissonance or the harsher harmonics that would come out of an electric guitar, particularly in rock music. Not that I was playing the music loud; it was just the overall vibration. So you're talking about something that's definitely frequency-oriented. In fact, I tap into that in metaphysics, that very energy you're talking about. It's everywhere, and it has multiple purposes. You know, we, those of us who are intuitive, tune into that energy. We can synthesize that energy, if that makes sense, or transmute that energy. And that could be into healing, or it could be into thought, or a perception, or it could be converted into music, some inspirational art, or through some message. There are quite a few possibilities to transmute it into another form without destroying the energy itself. It's always there, and it's always got everything about it. There's nothing that I can really take out of it, if you understand what I mean. It cannot be destroyed. Let's say.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. It has an incredible persistence. As a matter of fact, one of the key elements in this theory that I'm interested in presenting for you tonight pivots on that exact point, because this early experiments of Clave Baxter's, I think it was done in New York, basically what he noted was that he connected his lie detectors up to a plant and was very, very surprised to find that there were electrical patterns being emitted by the plant which looked very much like emotional responses. And so then he started doing experiments. Like, for instance, he would take live brine shrimp and pour them into boiling water in close proximity to the plant, and it just responded with what you might call shrieks or some type of responses of horror, as if it was perceiving the agony of the shrimp. And he did a lot of different experiments in that vein, which seemed to indicate that the plant is capable of perceiving these things, excuse me, and doing so irregardless of distance. Now, the other thing that he did, which was quite extraordinary, was that he took two plants, one of which was wired up to his lie detector, and another one which was just sitting nearby, and he had a bunch of people file past the plant, and the plant had various responses, but nothing alarming. And then one of the people had a hedge cutter with him and suddenly just chopped the other plant all to pieces. And, of course, the plant that was being monitored went berserk in terms of the signals that it was sending out. And then they gave the thing like 3 or 4 months to calm down. And one day, without any notice, they filed another group of people past the plant. And in that crowd was the individual who destroyed the plant previously. And the minute that he got within 2 or 3 feet of that plant, it again went berserk, indicating that it recognized the individual and was expecting some sort of attack upon a person, and indicating these vibrations of fear or terror.
Uh-huh. And now, is that plant still alive, to your knowledge, Jim?
I don't know about that particular plant, but I can tell you what evolved from this, because I knew guys who were actually working on this. And what they eventually found out was that once a plant is conditioned to a particular emotional response, it continues to do this, and so do the parts of the plant continue to react. It doesn't even have to be the whole plant. And then what they did was they took a leaf from a plant that was conditioned to an emotional response. Like, for instance, if a man thinks about kissing his wife and they register a particular electrical response from the plant while he's creating that mental imagery, that can be discriminated out and used to activate an electronic switch, let's say, to open a garage door, just to give you an example of what kind of experiments were done. And then they found that even a piece of that plant would produce the same result. And then they took and literally carbonized the leaf, and they found out that the carbon from that leaf, after it was detached from the plant and after it was burned to a crisp, still registered a change in its conductivity in response to that original stimulus. So they actually came up with a transistor-type solid-state device that operated by examining the conductivity changes in a piece of carbonized plant leaf from a conditioned plant, and they made this part of a circuit, and they found that this reacted instantly to that same thought stimulus, irregardless of distance. So that theoretically an astronaut on the other side of the moon could think about kissing his wife and open his garage door without any radio or any normal means of communication whatsoever. And that experiment has been done many, many times. And the interesting thing about it is the military got a hold of that back in the 70s, and only God knows what they've done with it since.
I think it would be very interesting for us to just march a group of political candidates past the plant and just measure its reaction. We could pick our leaders that way,
Well, in that case, you'd probably wind up with the Jolly Green Giant for president.
or make it a Venus flytrap,
Well, there you go.
Well, what you're describing makes a lot of sense, and it's really simple. I mean, you're just talking about a specific application and a specific form of this energy that permeates everything. Really, it's almost as if it's a color or just a particular frequency.
Well, and Tesla used to look at it as a continuum. In other words, that everything was actually connected by this other force, especially living things, so that even though you might be separated by thousands of miles or hundreds of thousands of miles, the ultimate response was as if there was a lossless connection between the two. And so, as you know, when he was using the magnifying transmitter for early experiments in these directions, he made claims to the fact that he had received some sort of intelligence signal from beyond the Earth in response to some of his experiments. And I don't believe that Tesla ever really spelt it out in cold, hard facts that he had received signals from a specific planet. But I know that the reporters of the time came up with the fact that the planet Mars happened to be closest to Earth during the time period that he was making these experiments. And so they printed articles to the effect that he was probably communicating with intelligent beings on that planet. Now, what's interesting is, of course, if he was using this type of bioelectric energy field, he could very well have been communicating with another galaxy just as easily as he could have been communicating with Mars. But Mars has always represented a fascinating link with Earth. And intuitively, I've always felt that there is something to it. I remember, as a young kid, I had read a book in which they talked about the interesting fact that the city of Cairo, which of course borders on the location of the Great Pyramid Complex in Giza, if you pronounced the Arabic name for the city, which apparently is different from Cairo, the direct translation of that word, and I don't remember what it is Mars. And there's an awful lot of ancient writings and whatnot that seem to corroborate the possibility that there was, at one point in time, some type of exchange between beings on Mars and Earth. Now, whether they were Earth people that were on Mars in a previous era and enjoying a colony there, or whether they were a separate group of beings who came to Mars first and then visited the Earth, those things are not clear. But back in the 70s, I think it was, we started to hear when they first started to send the the probes up to Mars, we started to hear about the possibility of some remnants of civilization being on the planet. And it was Hoagland, I believe, that came out with the first reports about this in his writings about the face on Mars. Isn't that correct, Don?
Yes, he was one of the first ones. Now, I know from... I'm going to digress for just a moment here. You mentioned the pyramids. The ancient writings talk about the pyramids having been completely encrusted in a layer of alabaster that was eventually stolen through all the raids that were perpetrated by treasure hunters. They literally stripped all the alabaster off of the pyramids. But from space, that would have been a beacon. And then there was the association with Mars being the war planet, or representing war, and that whole concept was attributed also or looked at and espoused by the Nazis during World War II. There was speculation that they had flown some crafts up there and to the moon during that period, or while Tesla was still alive, possibly. So when you consider, we've talked about how his materials had been stolen, many of his inventions and his writings, and that they had fallen into foreign hands, it was very likely that that they were actually developing his technologies, and that he, there was, as far as we are concerned here as Americans, in general, his information was suppressed, was not in school at all. His name was never brought up once in all the years that I was in school.
Well, and it's still significantly suppressed, except that he has an unbelievable following now, you know, regardless of the efforts to do that. But
Hoagland has been
Richard
Hoagland has been the expert, you know, to answer your question about the face on Mars, but there are many other anomalies up there too, and
on the moon, as I understand.
Yes, on both places. Now Mars has some interesting features, and I've seen some photographs that actually have alien writing, alien numbering and lettering on the corners of the pictures, and there are some what appear to be skulls or skull and crossbones in a couple of areas. My perception metaphysically or psychically has always been that there is green grass and blue water up there, and that what we're seeing in these pictures, for instance, if you were to Google the word Mars, the first thing that comes up on Google is three images of Mars, and they're all orange. And it's interesting that the ground is orange and the sky is orange. Why is that? You know, and I know that that's phony. I just know it's phony. That they're just filtering this, they're hiding something from us because they don't want us to know, probably, that there are several colonies up there of our people.
Well, it's very interesting that you mention that because... when I was a boy, I grew up in New Jersey, as you know, and I was only across the river, which is like a subway ride away from the Museum of Natural History in New York, which was one of my favorite places to go with my dad. And, of course, in those days, linked to the museum was the Hayden Planetarium. And they had a hall dedicated to exhibitions on each of the planets at that time. And one of the most astounding images that I'll never forget it as long as I live was of Mars. And you could see the planet, you know, clear as a bell. It had been taken through one of the, you know, largest optical telescopes, like Mount Palomar, for instance, or one of those observatories. And you could see white ice caps at the poles, and you could see the almost blood-red nature of the planet itself, and then these incredible green areas that came down almost like dripping paint across various parts of the planet, giving both the impression of canals and also of dispersed areas of vegetation. And I bought a postcard, or a giant postcard of that picture, which I still have to this day. And the thing that's most striking about this whole scenario is that if you see pictures of Mars now, it looks more like the moon or the Sahara Desert or you know, possibly Monument Valley or someplace like that, completely devoid of any coloration or any suggestion of vegetation. Rarely did they mention the ice caps, if at all. And there is no coloration and no vegetation or even hints of green displayed in any of the more modern pictures. And I was always flabbergasted by this, because the earlier writings about Mars always capitalized on the unusual aspect of the planet's coloration and the intense green areas, which seemed to designate vegetation, and the fact that the ice at the poles waxed and waned with the seasons, suggesting that there was melting conditions going on, and that the green areas would get darker as the ice melted. And I was very surprised later in my life when they supposedly reached the planet with these probes that none of this was ever verified, reported, photographed, or even commented on. But the most notable thing that happened was after those probes had been sent there, you no longer saw the traditional red and green photographs of Mars ever again. And that, to me, is a real red flag.
Well, it's funny that they could spend millions or even billions of dollars getting these probes up there, these rovers, as they call them, and they get up there and they stumble into a rock and they can't move anymore and they become dysfunctional. Well, there was a particular camera at one point, this was maybe a year or so ago when we were hearing about the disaster of the first and then the second launching and landing there, that these probes became dysfunctional, that they weren't sending clear pictures, and that they had shut down. Well, to the contrary, my feeling, my impression is that they didn't want us to see the pictures, number one. They were still receiving photos. It's just very easy to tell the public that it's not working, and there's the excuse for not showing anything. But all of a sudden, these probes became active again, and the dirty lenses were all of a sudden clean. Now, how do you think that happened? How did they didn't clean themselves?
Someone oh, sure cleaned they did. It. They had a robot arm and a box of Kleenex tissues, you know.
And a bottle of Windex, right?
Yeah.
Well, obviously there was someone there to clean it, okay? And that's how they were able to get it back online. I mean, it was obvious that the pictures it was sending were dirty, and it was a physical obstruction on the lens that was causing that. So they just stopped sending us the pictures. They had somebody go out there, and they had. Now, there are going to be listeners that are saying, wait a minute, this is a little bit too far out there in left field. But my take was that, and I've always said this, I've said this to you several times on this show, Jim, that my intuition tells me that we've been up there since at least 1962. And there's further information that comes out that from other researchers, and some in the know, that we've been there since 1961, that we had a joint expedition with the former Soviets. So if that's the case, then we were up there before we went to the moon, or at least when they announced that we went to the moon. which occurred, what was it, July of 1969, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, I think you're right.
So, you know, why is this going on? Why are they not telling us the truth about what's going on? That would be one big question. Well, it's like anything else on this planet, and it doesn't matter what the topic is. When the government is involved in it, they cover up what they don't want people to know. It's about control. It's about power. Now, going back to what we were discussing, we were talking about these energies that Tesla was tapping into. And virtually, I can tell you from a metaphysical standpoint, there is no limit to how far you can send the signal or receive a signal. There, time and space are of no concern in that respect, because that energy permeates everything. So Tesla obviously tapped into that. And if he had tapped into that, would it be unlikely that he would maybe not understand or know about the concept of dimensional portals, or what they're calling wormholes now? Would he have known about those, do you think?
Well, I think that's a difficult question to answer, but we can hypothesize a little bit on that subject by noting the fact that Tesla was very adamant that the explanation for the force of gravity had nothing to do with four-dimensional space and four-dimensional centrifugal forces as suggested by Einstein, and rather that the force of gravity was caused by very measurable and very easily understood physical parameters that were somehow associated with motion, either the motion of a planet or the motion of these energy fields or whatever. And he threatened, literally, to debug Einstein's special theory of relativity and the proposed explanation for gravity in the eventual publishing of his dynamic theory of gravity, which an awful lot of people looked forward to. And of course, he changed his mind and never provided that information to the public. But that doesn't mean that he didn't have an understanding of gravitational fields and all of the aspects that may go along with that. And if, in fact, he had committed that information to paper, originally intending perhaps to publish and then changing his mind, it could very well have been stolen from him when he was murdered or otherwise obtained by government agents. And if that's the case, you had quite a few years between 1943, when Tesla died, and 1961, or 62, whatever year it was, when these trips were made to that planet to engage new types of technology and to put some of these perhaps gravitationally propelled craft into space for the purpose of reaching that planet. Of course, one of the most disturbing things is that they do all this with our money, and yet they decide that it's not our business to know what they're doing. And that's really annoying. Just imagine the way information of that sort would change the belief structure on Earth and what it would do for the opening of consciousness here to realize that there not only have been other civilizations on other planets, but that life permeates the entire universe, and we are only one example of it, and a very small, pathetic example at that. I think that, as you said earlier, Don, the main reason for doing this is the mania for total control and total subjugation of the planet. rather than for the true purposes which the Almighty had allowed this information to be had, which, of course, is for the enrichment of all beings.
Well, that's a valid point. What is also occurring is that energy is being ramped up considerably, and it's having an effect on the overall human consciousness on a planetary basis. So you have people awakening and becoming conscious of what is going on, and this scares the dickens out of them and is directly attributed to why they are ramping up all of their negative activities and their control. You know, they're passing these laws to restrict our movement and restrict our speech, as if that's going to stop this energy from coming in and waking us up. And they know that, and they will not acknowledge that. You'll never hear any of them acknowledge it. But, that's what's going to prevail eventually. So this is a temporary dilemma.
Yeah, well, I think that the evolution of the planets and the expansion of human consciousness is probably a basic precept that permeates all of the cosmos. After all, if you didn't have anything but stagnation, what would be the purpose of life? I mean, it stands to reason that there's a great deal of wisdom in the concept that through our own efforts, we should be able to evolve into as great a civilization as we care to become. And I think that that's a normal tendency. But it's definitely been interfered with by these megalomaniacs who feel that they are the only ones privileged to have information. And they're perfectly willing to enslave the rest of the world to get what they want. And, of course, that's a basic wrong, which eventually has to be rectified. And I'm not sure how that rectification is going to come about, but I can tell you this much. My gut feeling is that if we don't take matters into our own hands and decide to secure the destiny that is our normal birthright, then eventually the planet itself will take the upper hand and wipe the slate clean, and we'll be back to square one and start all over again, as has already happened at least 5 times on this Earth, as you know.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually occurring to some extent right now. It's ramping up. However, I think the difference in this go-round is going to be an elevation of consciousness of the planet itself, and those that care to go along with it. And falling by the wayside are going to be those that are operating in the dark, operating through all this obfuscation and concealment and deception. That's my take on it, and I have to trust that's what God has shown me. That's what I know is going to happen. And there are others. I'm not alone in that feeling. Especially on BBS radio. Many of the hosts have a similar belief in the same message. We may arrive at that point via different methods, but ultimately we're all seeking the truth. And the truth is the truth. It doesn't matter our ability to perceive it or how we filter it through our senses or how we process it through our faculties, whatever those might be. Everyone is really at a different level. But this energy that you've been alluding to, which is really a life force, it's everything that is. In its pure sense, in its untapped sense, it holds tremendous possibilities for creativity and positive consciousness. And unfortunately, it's historically been used or misused by those controllers for their own gain, their own benefit, as if somehow they're smarter than us. But also contrary to that energy is their own creation, which is the illusion of fear. And that is a very destructive force. Everywhere you see fear, there you have some element of destruction. And the energy you're talking about, Jim, is totally about creativity. It's about making things happen.
Well, that's absolutely true. But you know what's interesting? You talked about this this division of humanity. Those who want to essentially go to the, let's call it the light, and those who prefer to go to the dark side and spend all of their energies in that direction. And it's interesting that H.G. Wells, of course, wrote the famous story, The Time Machine, where his hero in the story produces this device that allows him to travel in time, and he goes into the future and finds that humanity is divided, and that you have the Eloi, who are very cattle-like, innocent, naive, just spend all their day frolicking and what have you, and I forget the name of the other creatures that lived underground, who are essentially controlling everything behind the scenes and feeding on the Eloi. You know, in a sense, that's really what we have now. You have these megalomaniacs who are running the planet the way they want to, and essentially they're feeding on the labors and the intellect and the wealth of the more normal people who are just trying to get on with their lives and who would love to see the day when they had a little more time and a little more money to pursue cultural and intellectual and spiritual things rather than just shoveling all their wealth into the endless black pit of paying off their debts, which, of course, as you know, is all arranged for us by these other individuals.
Yeah.
Kind of an interesting parallel.
I forget the name of the ones that were underground, but they were eating, if I remember correctly, they were eating and cooking the people. You know, maybe they were reptilians in disguise. But, you know, the message, the sort of ambivalent naivete of the Eloi was really interesting. They were all like young people. They were all of the same generation, and they were just like zombies walking around. I think there's a strong political message in that, you know.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, there is.
And that's sort of like putting the mirror in front of us, and you watch and you say, wow, these people are really vegged out here. I mean, they're not aware of anything. But at the same time, and that was in the future, that was alluding to the fact that eventually people would just be robotic almost. That was a bit prophetic in a sense, and definitely describing the master plan. We were given a hint there, much like we were, you know, in the Wizard of Oz. You know, the word Oz is OZ is the abbreviation for ounce, and it applied to the gold. Follow the yellow brick road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's carefully crafted language that was there, and these metaphors and like the abbreviation, just everything, you know, even the wizard stood behind the veil. Well, Wells' book alluded to many things, but I think there were also a lot of scientific secrets in there based upon fact.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, another one of his books, which is very appropriate for tonight's conversation, was First Men in the Moon. Because he actually talked about the fact that there was a civilization on the moon. He talked about the fact that the moon was hollow and that it was internally populated rather than externally populated. If I remember correctly, they had set up a laser reflector on the moon at one point, and when they jettisoned one of the primary rockets that they used to power the return craft, and it crashed on the surface of the moon, this laser reflector actually picked up the fact that the moon rang for something like 20 minutes, just like a big bell. Which would seem to indicate that it was hollow. Anyway, the point being that H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and some of those other folks seem to have a great deal of knowledge about stuff that was not yet in the public consciousness. And as you say, that they portrayed this information in the guise of novels, but apparently they were tapped into something pretty real.
Yes. Now, I'm glad you mentioned that. This is kind of coming back full circle, and we're just about out of time, but I wanted to address what the comment that you made about Richard Hoagland. Richard Hoagland was recently interviewed by Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy for ProjectCamelot.org, and there are close to three hours of interviews. One is definitely about an hour, and the other two are a little bit shorter segments, but he is producing some evidence, photographic evidence, and an extreme analysis of anomalistic photos on both the moon and Mars. And what is interesting is this just came out very recently, and I did a show on this last Thursday. I talked about this. I don't mean this week, but the, last week, Thursday. And I basically spilled my guts about stuff that I knew that existed and was going on, and this was just an overwhelming feeling from my intuition that this needed to be said for some reason. And what Hoagland came out with on these videos was startling because he was saying the same things, but he was also adding some proof in some of these photographs. He was analyzing the light in retouched photos that NASA was releasing, where they wash out the stars and from the sky, and they claim there's a he talks about why they do this, that there's a particular reason that they have to do this in order to be able to see the things that are on the planet, the surface, we'll say. It's not considered a planet, it's a satellite, so on the satellite. But he's showing light bars that are appearing in the area where you would see stars, and these would have to be reflections or refracted light that appears in the photograph, because there would have to be some sort of a glass structure. So they ran this film through various types of filters, and they were able to produce architectural lines that are kind of grainy. They're removed, and yet they still appear in the photograph. Very interesting stuff. And he's using the same technique to analyze the washed out or whited out pictures of Mars in the same way. Now, I didn't hear any discussion about green landscape or water or plants, anything like that, but I've read this beyond having said this for a number of years. I've been telling people this for the past 30 years, Jim, that these are my impressions about the moon and Mars, and it's looking more like that's accurate than not. Not to mention the number of anomalies that are appearing on the surface of Mars. I think I showed you one photograph that had a stadium and a city on it, if you recall that.
Yeah, I do, and I would just love to see this stuff really hit the general public, because I think the impact would be incredible. But it's only going to come out in dribs and drabs, and even then we got to do a lot of squeezing to make it happen.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to in the next week, take a look at these videos online that I had mentioned to you. You can go to projectcamelot.org to see them. I'm going to post the links on my website, by the way, and so that anyone visiting my site, directlightproductions.com, can go there and just go directly to the Project Camelot site. Some people prefer to have you hold their hand a little bit when they're navigating the Internet. But maybe you would like to comment on some of that presentation that Hoagland gave on next
week's
show. Yeah,
I'll be happy to take a look at it, and we can talk about it next time.
Yeah, because it's right in line with what we're doing. Now, what's interesting, Jim, is that I brought this up last week, Thursday, and it was after last week, Thursday, that I became aware of these interviews. And it was the same topic that he was discussing. So there's a timing thing going on here. The universe sort of awakens all of us up at the same time, which gives tremendous credence to what you've been talking about with this energy, which in some languages it's called life force, prana in Sanskrit, which is life force, and chi in certain martial arts, again, life force. And this is everywhere. You could say it's in the ether, and obviously Tesla had tapped into that. He had become aware of that knowledge. And the more attention you pay to it, I'm sure you would agree, the more you begin to understand. It becomes second nature.
Oh, I agree with you full-heartedly, because it's like any other form of knowledge, you know. The first thing is always to just realize it's there. And then the second thing is, the more you examine it and the more you work with it, the more it becomes like a part of you, like an extension of you. I mean, the miracles that people do in the Orient with chi even today, not only in martial arts but in medicine, is astounding. Mm-hmm. And yet here in the West, we still don't believe in it. So.
Yes. You know Randy Weitenheimer, and I'm sure some of what he knows has rubbed off on you too.
Well, Randy not only uses chi in his work, but he actually has worked out a method of control and analysis, which is striking. And anybody that's interested in this sort of stuff should really try and get some of his information, because it's one of those things you can teach yourself, and
yes,
that's always worthwhile.
Well, I'm planning on having Randy on the show before the end of the month here, so which you know about. So hopefully he'll be able to talk about that with us. That's a great topic anyway. And
sure.
The BBS listening audience is not as familiar with him, but when I was with that other network, he was on the show and was very interesting. And I think that was a three-hour show that night. It was, and when we were done, we both felt like we could go another 3 hours. It was really, really energizing. Great
yeah,
spirit
I know
there.
The feeling.
Okay, well, Jim, we're about out of time. We covered most of what we wanted to talk about, but there's a lot more to cover. So, with your permission, we'll revisit that topic next week as well.
Certainly, no problem.
Okay, folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm Don Nikoloff, and our special guest this evening was the now famous, or should I say infamous, Jim Murray, and he'll be back with us again next Friday. Please listen into the show. Don't forget, we've got the Ron Paul special happening next Wednesday, January the 23rd. From Winter Park, Florida. You don't want to miss that three-hour event. And you get to hear some good music. And if you're in the Orlando, Winter Park, Florida area, by all means, stop in at the Haven and become a part of that Ron Paul rally. In the meantime, I want to thank you for listening to the show. Also, we want to thank Don Newsom and Seth Hendrick for the wonderful work they're doing in getting the show together here for me and with the sound. And with that, we bid you adieu and good night. Have a great weekend.